This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized, and with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com, that's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
November 8th, it was just a regular day in Tennessee. You know, we were just hanging out, and around 11 o'clock, I had talked to my mom earlier that day, and then at 11, she calls and says that our house is on fire. The house that I grew up in that she still owned, and she was in Georgia at the time. She's staying with my brother. And so I'm like, okay, do you have insurance? You know, that's like the first thing that I thought of was, you know, if she had the insurance that could cover it. She said she did. So that was kind of, I was like, okay, well, I didn't think that anything of it other than the fact that the house was on fire. I thought it was maybe an electrical issue or something. You know, it was localized to our house. But then I started seeing some Facebook posts that I kind of breezed over at first. Then I started seeing some real serious posts of my friends doing Facebook Lives or doing some kind of video or photo post of them surrounded by flame, looking like it's completely pitch black out except for the flames all around them. And then I realized what was going on, and that was about 11:30 in the morning over in Tennessee. But over there, you know, it was, people were just waking up to flames in their yard. And so that fire, they called it the campfire, and it was moving at a rate of 80 football fields per minute. This is FLW Tour Pro Miles Berghoff, and this is the Tom Rolen Podcast.
Hey, everybody, welcome to the show. Today, we got a good one for you. One of my first guests ever on this podcast was my friend Miles Berghoff. He is also the host of Sweetwater, a show that we produce, and just an all-around good guy. Miles is having an awesome year this year. He just made the FLW tour, so we're going to talk about bass fishing. And, you know, there's a lot going on with bass fishing right now. There is the traditional tours of the FLW and the BASS tour, but then there is the rise of the MLF, the Major League Fishing Tour. So I wanted to get Miles's perspective on that. And so we talk about that. And also, I know that Miles has a connection to the fires in California, and wanted to find out about that because I was pretty sure before this conversation that he grew up in one of the towns that was hit the hardest, and I was right, Paradise, California. Miles has a tight connection there and some pretty good stories. So give it up for Miles Berghoff. He's the host of Sweetwater and a good friend of mine, and I'm happy to have him on the show. All right, Miles, thanks for coming out and doing this, man. Since the last time that we have done a podcast, you have had a lot of changes.
Yeah, a lot of things have changed. I believe that I was one of the first for the podcast.
You were.
Yeah.
You were definitely one of the first.
Yeah. And so a lot has changed for you too. But yeah, everything's really, really exciting right now. This is really exciting times for me because a lot of things are coming together, not only in my personal life, but in my career, which is really cool.
What's going on? Tell me about what you got going on. I know a little bit about what you got going on, but what all has changed since the last time we talked?
Well, I think the last time we talked, I was actually looking to move over here. And now Katie and I, you know, we moved from California, Santa Cruz, over here to Tennessee. And so that part of our life has changed everything, you know, logistically. You know, she's working for a great dentist in town. And so we're both just loving that move. And then right now we're looking to buy a house.
You know,
we've got the down payment to buy a house. So that's a really exciting time and kind of frustrating too. You know, we both have boxes that we need to check and they may not be exactly the same. So we're kind of figuring that out, but it's still exciting nonetheless. And then the career, working on Sweetwater season 5 is being shown right now, which is really exciting. And then making the FLW tour is pretty much the big thing that's happening for me right now.
Yeah. And so you made that and then you went to the first tournament.
Mm-hmm.
And I was watching through Instagram mostly.
Sweet.
And saw that you did really well in that one. What was it like to be fishing at that level?
Well, number one, you know, you're going into the first event of the level of fishing that you've been dreaming of for your entire life and aspiring towards. You know, once you get to that level, if you've kind of tested yourself over time with that kind of with competition in general, you know, you have the skill and you have the mindset, but then there's always that little question in the back of your head: do I actually have what it takes? And so it could have gone, you know, all kinds of different ways, but it went really, really well. Everything kind of fit into place. I felt very comfortable out there. It was like once I caught that first big fish, the first day of the tournament, I said, this is what I'm born to do. Like, this is the same job I've done every single time. It's just as long as I don't crumple under the pressure. And it was just good to be able to do that and not, you know, falter because of all the pressure that I was under.
And where was this tournament?
This was Sam Rayburn down in Texas.
So how much experience do you have on that water?
Zero.
And so do you like that? I mean, that's kind of bass fishing, is going to unfamiliar water and being able to perform there, right? Like, I mean, that's kind of what a lot of people want the sport to become is, you know, you take these people and they don't know where they're going and you put them here and what happens? Like, how quickly can you learn that water? And so I don't know, but that's what bass fishermen are really good at, especially tournament bass fishermen. Mm-hmm. So what was it like for that particular body of water? When you see that, does it say to you like, oh, okay, I'm going to do fine here because it's got all these things that I like? Or what was it? What was that like?
Yeah, I think in the purest form of professional fishing, really, I like the idea of not getting a lot of information and just going out there and experiencing new waters and breaking them down as you go about everything. And that's kind of what I excel at, you know, kind of how I train myself. I mean, you know, my background, I was born in Florida, but moved to California. That's where I grew up. And we've got a place in Connecticut. So I had those two, you know, parts of the country, exact opposite ends of the country that I would kind of train and fish in each region. And then I moved back to Florida and then up to Alabama, California again, and then back over here. And I've fished in so many different regions. I've never been the guy to do extremely well in one region. I'm always the guy that's kind of like consistent. And so I feel like the years of me not focusing on one fishery and kind of putting myself out of a comfort zone when I feel a comfort zone, you know, starting to happen, I think that that's kind of helped me on the tour. Cause when I got to Sam Rayburn and saw that, you know, this fishery was essentially 8 foot high when we got there. And if you, in a lot of fisheries here in Tennessee, 8 foot doesn't mean a whole lot because you have very steep shorelines. It's not very gradual at all. But when you have a very gradual sloping lake like you do, like Sam Rayburn, that is surrounded by cypress trees and bushes, when you have 8 feet of water, that makes a tremendous difference. I mean, you can't even get to the shoreline in most areas. And sometimes it's like a half a mile deep as far as, you know, forest that you can't get through. So when I got there, my lack of knowledge and experience on that lake actually played in my favor, because a lot of guys were expecting to do, you know, a certain thing. And once they got there, you know, they tried to beat that dead horse the entire practice period, and they missed the boat, you know. And for me, I like going into a lake kind of ignorant of what the lake generally does, because most of the time when you have a tournament, there's some type of adverse conditions that you're going to be facing that are regular from just regular fishing. And so for me, just showing up, knowing the generals of the lake, but then also not knowing too much, helped me kind of break down the lake.
It's interesting. That weakness is strength. That's a theme that continues to pop up, you know, that sometimes, just exactly like what you say, in so many different ways, that your inexperience can turn out to be your greatest asset. And if you know how to spin it like that, you know, but it's interesting that happened to you there. So this was an interesting year for you to be making this jump to the FLW, because, you know, I'm kind of an outsider in bass fishing, but I'm a fan, you know, and I kind of follow what's going on over there, but not like an insider like yourself. But so tell me about what's going on between, I mean, at one point it was BASS, and then there's FLW, and those two are competing, like Coke and Pepsi, right? And then there's this other organization that has kind of emerged over the last few years that really made a big splash this year, right, in Major League Fishing. So what does that landscape look like right now?
It's volatile. it's different, because nobody knows exactly what the future's holding. Right now, actually, they're holding the first MLF tournament down on Lake Toho in Kissimmee, Florida. And, you know, I was watching some of the live coverage of that, because it is public information. And so I can watch that. It's interesting seeing that new format. I mean,
so what is the format? So explain the difference between the three different tournaments.
Yeah. So traditional tournament formats really consist of five fish per day. So you have a five fish limit. You keep those fish alive. You can take your smallest one when you catch a six fish, and throw it back for a larger fish as long as they're alive. That's the basic format per day. So the total weight, your total weight of those five fish is what ranks you throughout the day. And usually they're 3 or 4 days long. The top tours are 4 days long, and that includes FLW and Bassmaster. But then MLF came in with a circuit that does no weigh-ins, no live weigh-ins. They do some type of a live platform where they talk to pros at the end of the day, but from what I understand. But in general, they catch a fish, as long as it's over a pound, they get ranked by that fish. So it's the aggregate weight of all those fish that they catch throughout a day that are scoreable bass, which is a pound or more.
And they can do that? They can measure or weigh those on the boat?
Yep. They have trained marshals that have a scale that all of them are set. You know, they're all calibrated at the beginning of the day. They try to control everything. And then, you know, from what I understand, they weigh them right there on the boat, and then they release them. Mm-hmm. It's a cool format. Of course, most of us are used to the five fish, you know, limit, which is what we do on FLW, which makes for a really exciting weigh-in. And we also have a really good live platform on there too. Peyote Perriman, one of our producers, he actually produces that as well. But so that's kind of the differences between the three tours. And it's really interesting to see this new format come about, and a lot of the you know, the mainstays in the sport, the big names in the sport, you know, jumped over to that. So there's something to it. So I'm interested to see where it goes.
So in that format, a guy could catch 10 1-pound bass, and he would be tied with a guy that catches one 10-pound bass.
Exactly.
So it would lend itself to more action for the viewer, but it would also lend itself to fishing for smaller fish on purpose, right?
Mm-hmm. In theory, yeah.
Yeah, and then you could I mean, there's lots of situations, and, you know, I'm not a bass fisherman like you, but I've been bass fishing a whole bunch. There's certainly lots of situations where you can choose a bait where you're going to catch a lot of small fish, or you can, you know, swing for the fence and fish, you know, a giant worm or you know, a bait that's purposefully too big for the small fish, and you're not going to catch them, hoping that you're going to catch a big one.
Yeah.
And so people, do you think that the pros that are moving over to that are really all about that format, or there's like more social media, more coverage, more sponsors, more something involved in those tournaments? What's the draw there? Is it the format, or is it the something going on with outside of the tournament?
I'm not 100% sure. I think it's more outside the tournament, more of the outside deliverables that they see as of value, whether it's, you know, social media following and just more exposure for their sponsors. And they also don't have an entry fee. They voted against having entry fees for less, you know, for less winnings. And there's something to be said about that, because, you know, at the end of the day, if you have a certain amount of sponsor money at the beginning of the year, a lot of times, you know, a lot of that, if not all of it, is going towards your entry fees. And so you're starting behind the eight ball,
so
which is a little bit
fees,
different.
Entry fees on the other two,
mm-hmm.
What are they looking at?
On the FLW Tour, it's $35,000 for seven tournaments. So what does that work out to? $5,000 a piece. So that's a lot, but that's kind of the traditional, you know, tournament format, you know, you pay to play type thing. And they have paybacks that kind of represent that influx of entry fees.
And how many people will get paid on a tournament like that? We're paying 5,000
in our tournaments. We have 170 pros fishing, and we have 65 people getting paid at any event. So I think the lowest that you can get is $9,000. You're about doubling your money as far as your entry fee costs. So if you have everything already covered in the beginning of the year, you're making some money.
Yeah. And how many tournaments in the series that you're doing, how many tournaments are you doing?
Seven total. Yeah.
Seven tournaments.
Yeah.
And is that consistent with BASS?
Bass does a little bit more, and MLF, I think, does a lot more.
A lot more.
A lot more. So it's a lot more travel. That's why I love FLW, is the fact that I've been fishing their tournaments for so long, and I really like the kind of that family feel to it. They really do a good job at making you feel welcome, and they do listen to you quite a bit. So it's I like FLW for those reasons. And another reason is because I don't have to be away from home for that tremendous amount of time. Because more and more, my position as a professional fisherman is shifting less from just trying to make ends meet in a tournament to fishing tournaments, doing the best that I possibly can, and then focusing on the social media and delivery of the value ads that I propose to these sponsors that I, you know, mm-hmm. that I get.
I would imagine more and more, just like in every business right now, that's becoming more and more a part of it is it always has been for bass pros and for fishing professionals, but it, you know, before the age of Instagram and Facebook and social media, it was, you know, sports show appearances and Bass Pro Shops appearance or some sort of retailer. And that probably still goes on, because I know you do a lot of appearances and stuff like that, but it seems that the social media has added a whole different twist to it.
Yeah. Which I'm kind of behind the eight ball, my mindset of it. So it's something that I have to learn. We were just talking before the podcast about how the things that you think would trend in social media really don't get the traction. And it's so weird. And I have to revert from being a perfectionist to just being somebody that is trying to just get a genuine, organic, you know, message out there that doesn't necessarily have like the subtitles, you know, what my name is and all that, or you know, just that brushed up look to it. I have to like get away from that. And that's really hard to stop.
Yeah, it's funny. It seems like some platforms that type of content does really well. And if you put other kind of content on there, it tanks badly.
It's weird.
And then you have, you know, each one of the platforms I see, you know, Facebook has it. A video that will do well on Facebook is not necessarily a video that will do well on Instagram.
No.
And a video that does well on YouTube is not necessarily one that does well on Facebook or Instagram.
Yeah.
And so I find that, you know, to really dial it in, you know, it may be the same video, three different presentations of that video to get the maximum views off of it. But I mean, we swing and miss all the time.
Yeah.
Stuff that I think is going to be great, just fantastic. Yeah. And I look at it and I say, man, I could watch that all
it's
day
incredible,
long.
Yeah.
And it just tanks and you just don't see it. But, you know, sometimes you can post it later or at a different time or a different day or next month. And it will do not just a little bit better. It'll do a whole lot better.
It's almost like fishing.
Yeah,
it really is. I mean, you can bring it back to catching a fish. You know, sometimes you think that a certain bait will work and you don't get a sniff, but then you can throw a French fry on a hook. And, you know, I've seen videos like that. They throw a French fry on a hook and they catch a fish.
Yeah.
It's crazy, you know, our expectations and how they're not always met.
Yeah.
In something like
the funny
media.
Thing about when you bring it back to fishing is that if you go in there with a certain expectation and it's not working and you tend to just exactly like what you were talking about when these people went to this lake that you were just recently fishing and they had expectations on what was going to work and it wasn't working and they stick to it to death, right?
Yeah.
Like and it's too much. You can do the same exact thing with social media. You can do the same exact thing with anything where you just, if that's your expectation, it's not working, you know, sometimes it's best to try again, you know, but other times it's best to like try something else.
Yeah. it's weird because in fishing, I've trained myself to be fluid with the conditions and what's happening what's happening in front of me. But with social media, I'm still beating that dead horse. Mm-hmm. You know, I really do sometimes, you know, keep on doing the thing that's wrong and try to change something, you know, something a little bit, but it seems like I need to go a different direction. And I'm getting a grasp of it, but I think that just like it is in fishing or any type of business, I think that social media is just as, it's a little bit, we tend to overthink it. And I think that it needs to be something that's really organic and you get an instinct for what works and what doesn't.
In the last couple of years, how much have you seen your sponsor pool, the people that you're talking to, the people that you're proposing that they become a partner of yours in these tournaments, how much have you seen that change and sway towards social media in some way, shape, or form?
This was a really exciting year because, I mean, I'm making that huge financial jump. I mean, I'm taking a huge leap of faith, man, going to the tour because it's $35,000. I mean, I didn't have any clue where that was going to come from. And then over the years, you know, and it's a combination of all the different things that I've been part of, you know, being part of the show that you produce, Sweetwater, and just doing the things that I have been doing for a long time and learning what works and what doesn't. This year, it seemed to come together. Like I was able to put those proposals together and find out what the weakness is in a company and what their needs are. And I was able to actually convey that to them. And it worked out to the point where, you know, it was at the last second, but I ended up getting twice as much sponsor backing as I had my goal set at,
right?
Which was unbelievable. I mean, it really is a true blessing to be able to say that because not a lot of guys can say that, but it really came down to learning, you know, what a sponsor needs. A company needs to sell product, you know, and sell services. And some companies need, their needs are a little bit different. Like, for instance, I sold one package that was a non-endemic company. They wouldn't benefit from social media at all, but I threw a hospitality package their way. Hmm. You know, five, you know, bring your VIPs to Lake Chickamauga. I'll guide them for, you know, you get this many credits per year, that sort of thing. Finding out, you know, do they need to entertain people or do they need to, you know, have a good social media content package?
Right.
That's kind of what I was able to put together this year. And so over the years, I've been trending up even when things have kind of been shaky, you know, which isn't always going to be the case. I'm going to have some down years. I mean, that's a volatility of this sport and this industry is that you never know from year to year what it's going to be. That's why it's kind of scary home buying right now, because it's like we want this one house, but then it's like, well, this one's kind of the safety because I think we can afford this even in a lean year.
Yeah.
But it's different.
Man, that's an exciting time because I remember when we were fishing the redfish tournaments and we were putting down some, it wasn't $5,000, but as I remember, it was pretty significant and we didn't have it.
Yeah.
That's what's significant about it. It doesn't matter. The price doesn't matter.
Yeah.
What matters is do you have it, and how uncomfortable
is
this? Yeah, it's all relative. But we didn't have it, and we took a big risk. And at the same time, I'm having babies and trying, and I had bought a house, and now, you know, you're really putting something on the line when you pull into that tournament. Like it's on the line. And how do you think that affects your preparation, your mindset as you go into these things, you know, versus just a couple of years ago where you're, you know, I don't know. I mean, you might disagree, but you're kind of a couple of years ago, it was a different story for sure. You didn't have as much on the line as you do now. How do you think that's affected your preparation and mindset?
I honestly, it's weird. I feel more comfortable now than I ever have felt. You know, I feel like I'm in at the level that I want to be at. And now it's all up to, you know, the, like you said, the preparation and just doing the job that I've been doing all along and not being complacent and learning more. So I honestly don't, I feel like, you know, I've learned from mistakes as far as keeping overhead low. Like that's one of the biggest things that I've had is like, I'll be like, okay, I can afford this credit card. You know, I can max this thing out and afford it. It's only $50 a month. What does that matter? And, you know, oh, I can afford this car. I just need to sell a couple more guide trips a month. And it's like, I've learned that whatever I can do to kind of bring my overhead low is a really important thing. A few years ago, it wasn't a great spot for me because I didn't feel the progress moving forward, which I think was a really big issue for me because I've always been focused on, you know, my goals. I've been goal oriented. And when I don't see forward progress, it's kind of a depressing period of time. So now with, you know, my forward progress and kind of understanding like what my strengths and weaknesses are and kind of tripling down on my strengths, you know, including preparation, social media and everything else, it makes it a lot easier.
Yeah. Yeah. What's the lesson there for a guy that is, I mean, there's a lot of people out there that are right there where you were, like no forward progress, doing what they think is the right thing, not making any progress towards the goal or that they can see on a day-to-day basis. Like what's the lesson? How do you manage to continue to do the work when there's no progress forward that you're seeing? But
I think the only time you don't have progress is the one when you're spitballing and throwing things against the wall, but they're not your strengths. Like if you don't understand what your strengths and weaknesses are, that's one of the most dangerous things as a competitor or as a businessman or even at home. You know, it's like staying away from that one conversation that makes your wife angry. That's very important, you know, being a little bit more cautious and tiptoe around that. But knowing your strengths and weaknesses is I think, the most important thing that everybody should know for every walk of life. And it's the most important thing for me because I've tried to be somebody that I'm not, like tried to be that guy that is good on a certain social media platform that I don't feel comfortable with, or try to do that technique out there on the water that I don't feel comfortable with. And once you learn what your strengths are and the things that you enjoy doing, you know, I'll use fishing as an example. You know, I like shallow water power fishing and I like to do that. And it seems like whenever I do that, I tend to do better. But when I try to force feed something else, I'm fighting against other guys that's their strength. And then it's a completely different deal. The results are just terrible. So I think in general, step back, look at like what your skill set is, what you enjoy doing the most, and then triple down on that because you have a market, whether it's a market, you're catering to the fish or you're catering to a social media following or you're just catering to your family. You know, I think that whatever you do, that's your strengths, can really build momentum. I think momentum's only stagnant when you're trying to do too many things. That's my thought on the whole subject.
Yeah. Well, I like that. The building the momentum is huge. And you know, if you're just not seeing any forward progress whatsoever because you're constantly working on your weaknesses, that can damage your confidence for sure because you're just not doing well. But at the same time, you are doing well because you're working on your weaknesses. And yeah, it's not fun and everything. So there's a real fine line and a real balance between like tripling down on your strengths, but also not just running from your weaknesses. Like you got to, you got to at some point, you got to work on the weaknesses and make that weakness a strength. But that's the fine line. And being a tournament angler or being a professional fishing guide is a, it's just a metaphor on life. It's like, how much do you, how much do you plan on doing that shallow water power fishing and staying away from the deep water structure or whatever, because there's going to be a tournament that you go to and that's not going to work. And are you comfortable making that change or not? And you just compare that to anything in life. It's like, if you just focus on that one thing that you're strong at, it's going to work a lot of times, but not every time.
And then there's cycles too. Like if you're too good at one thing, when that cycle, like again, fishing, flipping has flipping and pitching is a shallow water tactic where you're fishing heavy cover. The old guys, Denny Brower, Tommy Biffle, those guys that were really well known for that, they dominated tournaments, you know, a decade and a half ago. But nowadays, more versatility is needed. So you definitely have to keep up with the times, but that your strengths are always going to be there to keep you propped up to where you don't fall too hard is kind of my perspective on it. And learning to trust your gut, I think, is probably one of the best things, you know, because your gut is going to tell you what's happening right now and what you need to kind of focus on. Like, because everything that you hear, all the information that you like, when I began, I just absorbed every book, every video, everything I could. Nowadays, I rarely do that because I've learned to trust my instincts and I kind of go with the flow and it seems to work. I'm not saying that you need to stop learning, but you need to learn the things that are relevant to you. Like if you can't compete against somebody doing a certain thing and it's so far out of what your core strengths and what your gut instinct can effectively tell you to how to approach it, then you should probably just, you know, avoid it and work on it on the out time, you know, like I do out on Chickamauga. I'm constantly fishing out there and working on my deep water strengths. And now, honestly, out on Chickamauga, I feel more comfortable out in deep water than I do in shallow water. So it's weird. You have to keep on learning. You have to keep on evolving.
Yeah. There'll always be that time when all of a sudden you're kind of like, well, I must have gotten better at this because now I feel like given the choice was always to do the other thing. And now all of a sudden I'm thinking, well, based upon, you know, all these different conditions, I think going to my weakness is the best thing to do. Yeah. And that's when I think, you know, that work has paid off and that you have turned a weakness into a strength. But that's such a fine line. Do you think that with, you know, when you were talking about that, it made me kind of think like this new format, like for all these years, you've had this five fish format. Mm-hmm. And of course you're talking about some of the best fishermen in the world. So you have to take that into account too, that of course these guys know how to catch small fish as well as they know how to catch big fish, but do they? I mean, like that's, Like they've made a living catching five big fish. Do you think this format is going to open the door to someone newer or someone that has different skill sets to really excel at this new format? Like now all of a sudden catching 10 small fish is the same as catching one big fish, where that guy couldn't even survive over in the old format.
I think so, because taking it, like looking at myself, like I said, I'm not the most dominant. Like I'm not going to be the guy with the biggest bag on average, you know, in tournaments. If you took the big bags of the season, I'm probably going to be kind of, you know, middle of the pack, but I'm more consistent. So in myself, in that kind of format, maybe, you know, would be pretty good, because you're going to different fisheries that you don't necessarily know. You have very little information. You're just kind of going with it. And then other guys that have kind of, you know, beat it into their brain that they need to catch the five biggest, it may be a struggle for them. So I think you're going to see a lot of different mix up as far as the standings and like who you see kind of dominate. But really, again, like you said, these are, you know, great professional anglers that have been around a long time. So I think that they can adjust to that format pretty good. I think,
I think it'll, you know, over in 2 years, it's not going to be an issue, but I think maybe on the first year of this big turnover, you might see some new faces. That's what I would think. And maybe, I don't know.
And that's the exciting thing about FLW right now is the fact that we've got a lot of anglers that, you know, in this may be a something that people criticize a little bit, but there's a lot of anglers that not a lot of people have heard of, but they're going to hear of them. You know, they're going to hear of a lot of those guys that are fishing the tour right now because they are great anglers. I've always said it, that the best tournament angler in the world may not be the best angler in the world. And so I really believe that tournament angling is so different than just traditional fishing.
Well, anytime you put any parameters around it, I mean, you can say the best charter guide in the world is not the best tournament fisherman in
the
world.
Exactly,
And it's absolutely. I mean, there are guys that have clienteles and they're booked for life because they're fun to be with and they always show you a good time. You always catch some fish. And if you don't, you're still going to have a great time. And it's just knows lots of jokes and just a fun person to be around.
Yeah.
Very, very entertaining. A person like that's going to be booked for life. A person like that may not place in the top 65 of the tournament, but it's a totally different thing. The guy that won the tournament may have a horrible disposition and nobody wants to be around him. And that's why he's a tournament fisherman because he can spend all day by himself. And if he's a charter guide, that's where he's going to end up too. So he might be the worst charter guide ever, the best tournament fisherman ever, the best charter guide ever, the worst tournament fisherman. Because all this guy wants to do is talk. He's going over to the other boats. Hey, what's going on? Nobody wants to talk to him. But I think anytime you put any sort of parameter around the fishing is that even if it's live bait versus artificial or offshore versus inshore or fly fishing versus, you know, spin or whatever, you're going to see that some people are way better than others at those little things.
Yeah. Kind of going back to, the new format and now that we have three tours, you know, I think they all have their strengths and weaknesses. And I think that FLW is really exciting because it has been more of a grassroots program, you know, and I'm excited to see some of the talent that they're bringing to the, to the forefront now. And they've got great media platforms too. So they're all, I think this competition that has happened in the industry, this shakeup is going to improve all three platforms.
Yeah. Competition always helps.
Really good.
You almost always helps. But one of the things, like, correct me if I'm wrong, cause I really don't know what I'm talking about, but it seems like Major League Fishing has been around for a while. This isn't the first year, but the big difference is that you like at some point you were able to fish. I mean, there were people like Ish Monroe was fishing BASS and FLW.
Yeah,
is that correct? And there were a couple of other pros and
it was
a major deal. Like you had to have several different rigs, two rigs and you'd fly back and forth between the two and jump in and fish this tournament and then go back over to the other coast and get back on the other deal. And there were a few people that were able to pull that off. But from my understanding, a lot of these tournaments were scheduled on the same weekends. I mean, there's 52 weeks in the year, so there's
only so much.
Have
and then
some
holidays, you know, and most of the time they don't do winter,
right?
You know, fall and winter.
So is that one of the things that made this year the year that you had to like choose?
Oh, I saw a window of opportunity with this whole shakeup because obviously FLW lost some anglers and Bass lost a tremendous amount of anglers from their platform that went over to MLF. And so I saw an opportunity, you know, as a young up and comer, you know, in the sport to this is the year that I need to take the reins and go after it and just go after it with everything I've got. And that's why I spent a month and a half, you know, searching for sponsor backing to be able to pay for it. So for me, I think that this whole shakeup really opened a door for me. And I think that it's the same thing for a lot of people in FLW and over in Bass too.
Mm-hmm. What when you're going to one of these tournaments, how far in advance do you leave for that particular tournament?
I'm usually leaving on either Thursday or Friday, and possibly Saturday, depending on I'm traveling with two FLW pros, Braxton Setzer and Rob Jordan, and whenever one of us, you know, books the house for, you know, obviously you want to get there as early as possible so you have a nice leisurely preparation time, get to know the area, know where all the amenities are and everything.
But there are rules as as like what is the practice period?
Yeah. So the practice period starts on the Sunday prior to the tournament, which starts on Thursday, and you've got 3 days, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. And then Wednesday is an off day, which I absolutely love. Mm-hmm. Having an off day.
So you can get to the location early, set up your tackle, get everything ready, but
you can't be on the water.
You can't be on the water and you can't get information. Yeah. And that's a funny thing because you pull up in your wrap truck
to get some gas. Everybody wants to throw you, information.
Yeah.
Everybody.
How do you deal with that?
I have to preemptively let them know. Like I was at Rayburn, I was getting ready for the final day. I was at a Dollar General just grabbing some supplies, and the lady in there was super nice. She was a local. She was just interested in what was going on, and she started like trying to show me pictures on her phone, you know, and I assuming that there's a bait in the mouth of the fish, I don't want that information. So I had to tell her, you know, hey, you know, I can't get any information at this period of time. So they understand that. And some people take offense to that, but it's nothing, you know, against them. It's just you have to preemptively do that because we do take polygraphs, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. So you can get there early. And so you're traveling with like two other people, mm-hmm. and then somebody's going to take charge of booking some place. And are you looking to be on the water? Or are you looking just for a safe place to keep all your gear?
At this next place we're staying with a good buddy of mine, Ted Sullivan. He lives on Toho, which is not something that's easy to find. There's not a whole lot of lakes that live, you know, right on the water. So we're going to get down there. I'm going to get down there probably Friday night and just kind of slowly get everything together. You know, we're probably going to have a cookout, you know, fry some halibut from Alaska, which keep on, you know, haven't brought you some. I should have brought some today. I feel bad now. But we're going to do that prior and just kind of leisurely get everything because you don't want to rush anything.
Right.
You know, I've learned that. You know, I always seem to do that. I call it future miles. Whenever I have a tight schedule, it's future miles' problem. And then I have to deal with it.
So where did you find your travel partners?
Rob Jordan's part of the Z-Man team, which they've been a great, Z-Man's been an awesome partner of ours on the show and me personally, both Joey and I personally outside the show. And so, you know, and it's just a great group of guys and he's one of the pro staff. And so I gave him a call and, you know, when I found out I was going to fish the tour.
That's cool.
Yeah.
And so even with those people, the people that you're traveling with and other pros, are you can't talk amongst yourselves?
You can only talk with competitors that are fishing the tournament. So for instance, if you fish the day three or day four and a pro has been cut out for those final days or whatever day it is, you can't talk with them. So if they're going to compete in the next day of competition, you can talk with them. But I generally don't tend to talk too much. You know, we talk about generals, but I think all of us kind of respect our own space and we'll throw each other a bone when it comes around. But, you know, it's generally the guys that I stay with, we just don't talk that much about specifics.
Mm-hmm. And are you guys traveling down there together, like in a convoy, or you just show up?
No, we just show up. Mm-hmm. Yeah, every man for himself out there on the road.
That's a lot of miles.
It is
a lot of miles on the road.
I guess that's why they called me Miles.
Yeah, that's right. Because you're going to put on a lot of miles. What do? Listen to books or podcasts, or what do you listen to?
Of course, I listen to podcasts. We've talked about it before. I listen to the Joe Rogan podcast a lot. I've listened to of course, some of yours, and listen to some fishing podcasts. I've kind of got out of the fishing podcast a little bit sometimes. I listen to Bass Talk Live, which is one of my favorites, Ike Live. I still listen to those, but it's also a time for me to kind of get my news intake
you know,
and understand what's going on in the world because I don't do that at home ever.
Mm-hmm. I'm on a news blackout.
Dude, it's actually a good thing. It's good to hear, you know, platforms like where you have long form conversations like we're having right here. Because you can actually talk about subjects, you know, in depth. But as far as news goes, I can't handle it.
I've been on a news blackout for about 6 years.
Good.
I mean, I don't watch the news and I don't read the newspaper. I mean, I just don't. I find out about it, you know, because, I mean, you know, the news cycle is so fast that while I'm not getting it on Twitter every single second,
yeah,
within a couple of hours, somebody's telling me about something of substance. Like, I just don't have to subject myself to that. And I don't know, most of the stuff that I miss, it's not even worth worrying about anyway. But man, it makes me feel a lot better to be on a news blackout.
Yeah. Amen to that. I mean, I try to stay out of the news as much as possible because it's just a crazy mess.
Yeah. Well, some of the news that I saw that made me think of you right away were the fires in mm-hmm. California, and you've got a serious connection to that.
Yeah.
What was that like for you?
So November 8th, it was just a regular day in Tennessee. You know, we're just hanging out, and around 11 o'clock, I had talked to my mom earlier that day, and then at 11, she calls and says that our house is on fire, the house that I grew up in that she still owned, and she was in Georgia at the time. She's staying with my brother, and so I'm like, okay, do you have insurance? You know, that was like the first mm-hmm. thing that I thought of was, you know, if she had the insurance that could cover it. She said she did, so that was kind of, I was like, okay, well, I didn't think that anything of it other than the fact that the house was on fire. I thought it was maybe an electrical issue or something. You know, it was localized to our house. But then I started seeing some Facebook posts that I kind of breezed over at first. Then I started seeing some real serious posts of my friends doing Facebook lives or, you know, doing some kind of video or photo post of them surrounded by flame, looking like it's completely pitch black out except for the flames all around them. And then I realized what was going on. And that was about 11:30 in the morning over there or over in Tennessee. But over there, you know, people were just waking up to flames in their yard.
Mm.
And so that fire, they called it the campfire, and it was moving at a rate of 80 football fields per minute.
Wow.
And I mean, you just think about that kind of speed. It breezed through so quick that, I mean, you look at the pictures, you still see green foliage because anything that was high enough, it was blowing so hard, you know, laterally that it just destroyed everything on the ground.
Wow.
And just breezed through at such a tremendous, you know, rate and just the heat. I mean, I had to call some of my best friends over there and see if they're okay. A lot of them I couldn't get through to because a lot of the towers had been destroyed. But some of them I, you know, talked to. Everybody that I talked to that was in town that wasn't in the next town over for work was still in the fire.
Wow.
Yeah, it was.
That was Paradise, right?
Yeah, Paradise, California. Yeah,
because they were saying that the name, when I did hear about this news and I finally, you know, break out of my news blackout to say, you know, what is going on in California? And the one story that I did see was talking about Paradise. And I was like, why does that sound so familiar? And then it wasn't long after that I talked to you and you were like, yeah, well, that's where I grew up.
Yeah.
And it's so weird when you see something like that, you know, catastrophic damage somewhere, and then you make a personal connection to that. Like, wow, that's where Miles grew up.
Yeah.
That's bizarre for me. And then for you, it's way beyond bizarre. It's like, those are your friends and your family and your house and your belongings and everything like that is going on in there. We deal with a lot of hurricanes and stuff, but that fire, I mean, 80 football fields a minute, that's faster than you can run.
Oh,
way faster.
Faster than you could drive in the traffic. It was the hardest part about the whole thing was just being away from it, not being there. You feel so helpless. You just want to help the community that you grew up around, and you just want to be there. You feel like there's this feeling of like FOMO, fear of missing out,
mm-hmm.
but it's not like fear of like the excitement of it, but fear of not being there for the people that you care about.
Right.
And that was the hard part, not being able to be there for people. And so we really wanted to go over there. Katie and I both grew up there. So Katie, that's where Katie and I met, was in high school, Paradise High School. And so it was, for both of us, it was a very hard time just seeing it from afar and not being able to be there to comfort our friends. And there was a point where we were just going to fly over while the chaos was still happening. But then we realized, you know, this is just going to eat up resources and we're not needed. Like, there's nothing we can do for them that we can't do from here. So we did open a GoFundMe page because there was, I mean, there, I think it was like 24,000 people were displaced, or it was at least 18,000 homes or 18,000 families that were displaced.
Wow.
And something like that. And it's 15,000 and change homes were destroyed in a matter of a day.
How many people lived there, do you think, before the fire?
Total, I think there was 30,000. So
50% of the houses done.
Oh, no. As far as houses, 90% of the houses are gone.
90% of the houses.
Yeah.
Wow.
Around there. The majority, the businesses seem to do better because they have a lot more space in between the trees and things like that. Like, parking lots kind of were good buffer zones. But it was so crazy how unpredictable, because we got to go there finally during around New Year's. And it was therapeutic being there. Number one, it was harder for me being over here and thinking about it. But when we went over there, it was a huge relief for all of us, I think, because we got to see it and people adjusting to it. And you got to see the reality of it, which is complete destruction. But at the same time, you're seeing people kind of surviving, you know, and that's kind of comforting. But when we went there and saw the destruction, like, I've never seen anything like it. I've never seen anything like it, because we went there and you would see a building that was perfectly fine, and then right next to it, a building that didn't even look like it existed. Yeah.
Wow.
The vast majority of the town was completely gone, but those businesses were the ones that kind of remained a little bit.
What happens with the 90% destruction? So what happens to the 10% that are remaining, that one building that's sitting there next to total destruction?
That's what I said. Like, that was one of the things I was just, Kitty and I would talk, I'd be like, I feel bad for the people that didn't lose their homes too. Well, because
now the whole town is wrecked.
Property values, that gray area that people fall in with insurance.
Mm-hmm.
So I know our neighbor, it's funny that we're talking about the people that did their houses did survive. Our neighbor survived next to our mom's place. And he's going to live there. He's all gung-ho about, you know, staying. But I'm not sure how it's going to work. I actually have one friend out of all my friends that their house actually survived. And it was out on the outskirts of the town up the mountain. So I'm not sure exactly what's going to happen with them. But it's, to me, hopefully it all works out in their favor in some way. Because I would assume that for at least the next 10 years or so, property values are going to be really, really bad, probably locked up, or, you know, I don't understand the economics about it enough to be an expert at it. But it seems to me that, seeing as that all the toxicity levels in the area, because you're talking about a lot of homes that were made of asbestos and lead paint and all these different toxic things, that's one of the main things, is we had to wear like major respirators and full painter's suits.
You don't think about that.
Our house was made of asbestos, you know, from what I understand. And so it's a lot of houses that were made back in the 60s and 70s that were destroyed. I mean, the air quality in Northern California was the worst in the world during that period of time. Yeah.
Wow. So, yeah, that's tough. I mean, we, over the last few years, and even back in the 90s, there were so many hurricanes that came through Florida that it was just, it's just one after another. If it didn't hit the Keys, it hit somewhere else. And it was just a constant part of life. But the best thing, as you said, was that after one of these disasters, you would see the community come together like no other time ever.
Yeah.
And I mean, people would do so much for one another, and it was just amazing to see. But unfortunately, sometimes you have to go through some really bad things in order to see that.
Yeah, that's a good point, because that's how I kind of feel about it. I'm kind of an optimist when it comes to that kind of stuff, because I see under the greatest struggles and the biggest disasters that it can be some of the best years of people's lives. And that may be it may seem insensitive to say that, but I think that people are going to look back and see how their community came together and people like reacted so well as a whole to those things that people's true colors kind of, you know, showed. And I think that as much as it was so destructive and deadly, because, you know, almost 90 people died in the fire, it happened so fast that I think that by and large, the community of Paradise is going to be a very strong, closely knit community because of it.
Yeah.
Which is hopeful to me. There's obviously still there's a lot of struggle ahead. I just talked to my friend Kenny on the phone yesterday, and he's just like, you know, I asked him how he's doing. He's just like, you know, he's the one that his house is still standing. And he's just like, man, we're just trying to learn a new norm, you know, as normal as it can be, you know, because every day he has to drive through the town that doesn't look at all like it used to.
Wow.
Nothing there. So it's definitely been disastrous, but I think that those type of events have an upside to it as far as.
Yeah, well, certainly I've seen the upside many times with hurricanes, and you're right, it does bind the community like nothing else. So on a lighter note, you've got so many good things happening for you in your life outside of the fires of California. You've got, you know, you're about to buy a house. You got the FLW tour going on. Sweetwater's proceeding on. What's next in your mind? What's next for you?
Keep on learning and keep on, you know, getting better at the things I'm not so great at, you know, and also the things that I'm pretty good at.
Yeah, both on and off the water.
Yeah, on and off the water, and just keep on evolving as a person, man. I think that's what it's all about. And so I'm really excited. I want to do some more. I'm definitely doing a lot more video content for the social media side, and really enjoying doing that. So it's a really exciting period of time. I'm really happy with the direction things are kind of trending for me, and I just don't want to rest on my laurels, man. I want to keep on going full bore.
That's awesome. So where can people see all of the new stuff that you're producing?
So number one, you know, of course you can watch Sweetwater. We've got three different platforms, I believe, and you can correct me. You're a little bit more in tune with the pulse of where we're being shown, but we're on NBC Sports, Sportsman's Channel, and then also Waypoint TV, which is outstanding. You know, anybody can watch it there and all our episodes. And then, Sweetwater Fishing TV. And then my own platforms, I'm really trying to push my YouTube quite a bit. I'm putting a lot of energy into that. And Facebook and Instagram are my other two that I really concentrate on.
What are your handles?
Sonar Fishing on Instagram and YouTube. And then Facebook, my professional page is Miles Sonar Virgo.
Okay, Sonar, because you are the master of the sonar.
And son of radar.
Yeah. Yeah, son of radar. That's right. That's exactly right. And then you have sonar because you do actually know your way around depth finder pretty well.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Well, I think everybody will go and check you out. And I really appreciate you stopping by, because it's cool to hear this whole bass world, because it's a little different. I mean, yeah. Really, for an outsider, I mean, you see these guys just showing up at these tournaments and everything like that, but I know that there's way more that goes into it.
Oh yeah,
there's all the travel and the balancing of the family life and the balancing of the budget, and it's expensive and stressful at times, I'm sure, but you seem to be handling it pretty well. And that first tournament went well.
I love the process. Yeah. That's what it's all about.
That's it. All right, Miles. Well, good luck to you. And we'll be watching. And hopefully this time you're going to make it to the final day.
Thanks, Tom. Really good to be here.
Yeah, man. See you, Miles.
Thanks.